Good evening, Sangha. So I had the good fortune to have a teacher. This is my community teacher, my local Sangha, who said over and over to us, we make our difficulties the path. We make our difficulties the path. We make our difficulties the path. You know, enough times that it stuck over time. You know, we have to hear the Dharma so many times, and luckily it sank in. And this means that we need courage. We need courage in the practice. And I've had the good fortune and the honor of witnessing a lot of courage showing up in your practices over the past several days. And we need that courage. We need the courage. It gives us the energy to persevere in the practice. And so that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm going to talk about courage, energy, and related qualities of spiritual urgency and patience. And I'm going to talk about these in relationship to both our practice here, continued practice here, and some, you know, more about daily practice. So talking about the encourage that we need for practice, the courage and energy, I'm speaking specifically about a quality of the mind that in Pali is called virya, V-I-R-I-Y-A. And this quality is essential and integral to the Buddha's liberation teachings. It has a complex meaning. It's kind of like dukkha. It's not really directly translatable into English in all the complexities or nuances of its meaning. So it's translated differently at different times, and you may see it translated as energy, just energy, courage, strength, vigor, vitality, persistence. A good definition for it also is gentle perseverance. And I see it really supporting resilience over time, resilience in the practice. So although it's often translated in, you know, like just as energy or effort, I think, you know, because of the root of the word, which is actually vir, has the same Latin root as hero. So it's really within even the root of the word is this sense that one has to have heroic effort, actually. So it's sometimes really translated as heroic effort. So the courage that one has to have to put forth the effort for practice, to have the energy for practice, is really built right in. So speaking of virya and using this translation of courage, Joseph Goldstein, one of the founders here, said, courage is not about changing anything or grasping for some better state. It's the valor of truly being present. So think about that. We have to have valor to just be present. And it's true, oftentimes. But it's important to remember the gentleness aspect of it. And, you know, I'll be talking a little bit more about what kind of effort we should be making, or we can contemplate and explore that we should be making. So Joseph Goldstein also says, virya is the willingness to stay with what is. When we use it, wisdom grows. The more we use it, the stronger it becomes. As we use it, we are developing strength of mind. It is a powerful force that also needs a gentle touch. So we need to remember that gentleness and, you know, the quality of harmlessness and compassion that's so important to the practice, has to be there as we exercise our courage, as we grow in courage, and as it comes into our practice more and more. So the quality of virya is so important to the Buddhist teachings that, you know, it's really incorporated in a lot of these listed teachings. The Buddha taught in many lists. They're various. Because the Dharma was taught orally and handed down orally for hundreds of years, part of making it easier to memorize was for people to, the teachings to be given in lists. So virya shows up in these really important groupings of teachings and lists, including the seven factors of awakening, which I've mentioned in here. It's one of the five spiritual faculties. It's one of the four bases of spiritual power. It's one of what we call the paramis, 10 paramis, which are the qualities of an awakened being that we're cultivating essentially over lifetimes. And just as a reminder, where it falls into the seven factors of awakening, because we haven't had a whole talk on the seven factors of awakening, but we've talked about most of the factors to some degree. So in the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness leads to investigation of phenomena or interest, which leads to virya, energy, which leads to enrapt attention, rapture, which leads to calm, which leads to concentration, which leads to equanimity. And over time, you can check out and see for yourself and ask whether or not you see these qualities leading to each other. Does interest bring energy and courage to be with what's present? One of the big sort of aha moments for me in the practice was coming back from a retreat and kind of realizing, oh, they really do arise in that. And they really do arise in that way. So one of the first things to say about virya, courage and energy and strength in the practice, is that as with all wholesome factors, qualities of mind, it's really important to notice them when they're there. It's really important to notice when you have courage to practice when something is difficult, and yet you persevere in holding it in mindfulness or practicing metta with that, when even though it's present, and cultivating a wholesome quality instead of that unwholesome one. It's just really important to notice that that is arising in you, and to appreciate it and to feel what it feels like. Because it will then tend to arise more in the future as we become more familiar with what that courage is, with the gentleness that it has to have with it. You know, it may be a quiet factor in the mind, but nevertheless very powerful. So one of my favorite teachings about virya, about this courage and energy, is classically, the manifestation of courage is non-collapse. The manifestation of courage in the practice is just non-collapse. So as long as we haven't collapsed, there is energy and courage in the practice. And I would suggest that even if you've fallen over, as long as you get back up, there's some, you know, some movement in the mind to get back up. There's some courage and energy there, you know. There was my first retreat, 1 month retreat that I went on, I fled to a meadow. This was in California at Spirit Rock Meditations. I fled to an isolated meadow, sat in the middle of the meadow and just cried and cried and cried. And, you know, contemplated, is there any way I could continue doing this? And I went back. So, and continued and finished that retreat, and it was profoundly transformative to face all of that, to face the fear, to face the doubt, and to keep on going. And so, you know, there's some virya there. There's some courage and there's some energy as long as you keep on going. You know, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, all you have to do in this practice is begin and not stop. You have to keep on going, right? So, there is a well-known, you know, very frequently quoted sutta in which the Buddha gave a teaching on the kind of effort and energy that we should bring to the practice. And it has this imagery of crossing the flood. And I'm going to share a passage from this sutta with you. And I love this Crossing the Flood Sutta because, so the flood is referring to the flood of the taints, you know, like rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion, taints of our minds, the difficulties, the suffering that we create with our minds. And so we're crossing the flood over to the other shore to experiencing, you know, cessation of suffering, to understanding that. So to me, this image of crossing the flood and this sutta about it, courage is just built into this image of the effort that we need to make, because, you know, it takes courage to just simply enter a flood and try to cross it. So the courage is there, and in the explanation of the kind of effort we have to have, I think the gentleness really comes to the fore. Granted, it's kind of mysterious the way this is, kind of effort is described, so you can just kind of listen and let it wash over you, and see how it might take root. So a practitioner, actually a celestial being, came to the Buddha and asked him, how do we cross the flood, he said. And the Buddha replied, "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" The Buddha said, "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. When I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood." So we continue persevering. To make it even a little bit more mysterious, Bhikkhu Bodhi says that the Buddha's reply is intended to be paradoxical. For one normally crosses a flood by halting in places that offer a foothold and by straining in places that must be crossed. So we're kind of going against the stream as we're crossing the stream, gently, carefully persevering all along the way. And it's extremely nuanced, the type of effort that we must bring with our courage to practice. So tying in some of the teachings we've recently had, as we move forward in intensive practice, and really over quite some time, mindfulness becomes more continuous, less effortful. At a certain point, you start to realize that we're not actually doing the practice. Practice is kind of doing us. And, you know, that can put us in touch with this truth of not self. As the practice unfolds, it's causes and conditions, and the causes and conditions that are arising in every moment are just carrying the practice sort of forward. And non-reactivity builds in the mind also, that equanimity that Annie was talking about and that Winnie also taught more about today. And at that time, it really, you know, as that really progresses in the practice, we can start to feel like mindfulness is just rising up and meeting objects really on its own. Along the way, we're constantly calibrating the energy we need for practice, constantly calibrating our level of effort, noticing and kind of adjusting, seeing how we over-effort, seeing how maybe we're falling back too much in effort, and we're just, it's a constant thing that we are checking out, noticing how turmoil can be made in the mind by just a little bit of over-efforting, and how we can bring more peace by just really actually, it feels like what we need to do is make effort and make no effort at the same time. And so that's in the practice sort of a lifelong journey of coming to understand. So Jesse Maceo Vega Fry describes some of that process this way. And he uses the term, I think, guerrilla yogi for practitioner, and I've just put in here practitioner. So one of the greatest challenges for the practitioner is development of the extremely nuanced sensitivity to the quality of energy that is present and the effort made to manage it. So often when we make the effort to increase our energy, we unknowingly also cultivate striving, forcing, and wanting. We generate a pressure on the present moment experience that is actually more interested in some future moment of being, something we are trying to achieve, some state we are trying to attain. Thus, in our attempts at cultivating energy, we undermine our efforts. For a beginning yogi, truly balanced energy may not be recognizable as energy at all because it does not have that sense of contraction of the mind that we associate with effort. True virya should not make us strain, should not create a sense of spiritual constipation. More often than not, the practitioner does not try to attain any unattained state of energy, but simply works with the level of energy that is present and makes the most of current conditions. So I think that it's fair to tell you all that this practice that we've been sharing with you is kind of famous for coming from the root of a practice that's very, very, that emphasizes effort and energy and virya very strongly, right? Sayadaw Upandita, who was one of the sort of, I think it's fair to say, proteges of Mahasi Sayadaw, who carried on a lot and taught a lot of the teachers here. He was known as the Virya Sayadaw in Myanmar, and known for really being a demanding teacher and constantly exhorting people to heroic effort. And as a part of doing that, you know, what the stories that get told are that often, you know, you would go in to report on your practice, and maybe something would come up, and you would say something difficult, you know, like tremendous fear came up in the practice. And the response would be, did you note it? You know, and come back the next time, did you note it? Did you note it? And in a way, this was, you know, and I practiced when in the last few months of Sayadaw Upandita's life at one of his forest centers. And, you know, I didn't have him as a personal teacher. He wasn't doing that at that time, but heard some Dharma, was there for some of his Dharma talks and so on. But in a way, this was, and is, I think, considered to be the expression of deep compassion, because what the pointing is towards really what you know, what the core effort is that needs to be made, and cutting through some of our delusion about, you know, the problem is this present moment experience instead of just our relationship to it. And so that pointing back and forth, back and back and back to did you note it, is about really supporting that particular yogi's path to awakening. So we have modified this practice here. You know, the Mahasi practice, as it's taught in Myanmar, oftentimes is very, it's just like you're noting all the time everything, every movement, going very, very slow with everything, reaching, lifting, opening, lifting, drinking, swallowing, placing. You can see I've done this, right? Placing again, lifting, moving. And so noting everything. And it wouldn't, you know, over time, the teachers here have developed practices to bring in really the important, you know, what we think will really support yogis here in these conditions where people are coming in and that's not what's expected. And they're coming in these conditions from, you know, busy jobs, busy lives. And so we've shifted the practice. But what to me shows the strength and the how really effective this practice is seeing all of you and seeing people who do what you might call Mahasi light, which is a little bit less noting, a little bit less exhortation to heroic effort, and seeing that work, seeing which is what we have seen over the last several days, seeing that people's minds open up more and more to the truth, able to be mindful more on a continuous basis, which in any event will lead to sunfolding, of the path in your lives. So when we practice in daily life, we need a particular kind of courage, different kinds of courage, right? And energy to meet the conditions of daily life. We don't have, you know, when we don't have the seclusion and the solitude here and all of the particular supports of this container, you know, the beginning again and again, that is the manifestation of virya here. Actually, though, shows up when we are able to bring some consistency to our practice. So that's one of the things that I'm going to suggest is really helpful in bringing virya into your life and daily practice and as a manifestation of it, is this consistency of the practice. So the consistency of not just the formal practice, you know, how many times a day do you sit for how long, but the consistency of also bringing the practice into your work life, your home life, you know, all the in-between times in daily life. So I'm a big advocate of, you know, the more you practice consistently, it's more important than the chunk of time that you're able to set aside for formal practice. You know, some formal practice, and then taking the practice into your life in the way of, I've talked to some people about stealth metta, you know, being able to go around and practice metta to people that you're just passing, or beings, animals that you're just passing. May you be well, may you be happy, may you be at ease. You know, I practiced stealth metta and mudita when I walked my dog for years. It was really a great support for the practice. Wonderful practice, and opened me up to the Brahmaviharas a lot. I practiced with my dog on this hill where I lived in San Francisco, and with the other dogs who were living in dog heaven, happy with their, you know, cared for by their families, playing around with other dogs. I just practiced mudita, may your good fortune continue and increase. And it was just like joy, you know, joy on top of joy. But I also stood on that hill and looked out at all these, you could see the highway and all the people on their, you know, like terrifying commutes that they were going on. I was like, may you be well, may you be free of suffering, because there was plenty to see in all the range of the 10,000 joys and sorrows that beings experience in this world. So courage in daily life practice, I think, also comes up with the conditions that we're living in, many of us are living in, as creativity in the practice. So really finding ways to practice, to bring the practice to those difficulties you have in life and make them your path. So how can you practice with the, you know, stuff that comes up at work or the stuff that comes up at home? Finding ways to bring in mindfulness, metta, compassion, equanimity. For me, I practiced as a lawyer for quite some years. You know, I think my last legal case was about a year and a half ago. But I practiced in a nonprofit law office for quite some time. And I had to practice with some pretty crappy mind states. As a lawyer, you know, it's hard work out there, right? And so one thing I did is I noticed when the most unwholesome, you know, when I had patterns of unwholesome mind states coming up in relationship to work. And one of them was I would get these judicial opinions, because I was a defense attorney. We get these judicial opinions and they would rule against me. And so I was literally being judged. And I often had a lot of reactivity around that. Lots of reactivity, pre-reactivity, you know, it would be like the email would land in my inbox and the stress, anxiety, and the anger, or whatever, all of that massive hindrance attack would come up. And I could feel it in many parts of the body and the mind. And I cultivated I will do metta for myself. As soon as I see that opinion come in, I will do metta. I will do it for as long as until I feel like, you know, a little bit steady enough to actually open up the opinion, and then I would practice mindfulness through that. And if I lost it, I would go back and practice metta partway through. And it shifted things dramatically over time. I was able to see the judges judging as just that and them doing their job more over time. So this is, don't just keep the practice in a box. This practice is not about that. And it's about being adaptive and creative. And this is like really bringing that energy, bringing that courage, that creativity, that consistency to the practice that really can propel it and bring the practice very much alive in daily life, very much, you know, closer and closer to the way it feels quite intensive on retreat. Because, you know, out there you're facing a lot, so it gives you a lot to work with, you know. So Ajahn Suchito, who's in the Ajahn Chah lineage, the Triforest lineage that Annie mentioned the other day, I think speaks really eloquently about this energy of this energy and this courage to bring the practice to our patterns that come up for us in daily life, and to be creative and really address and make our difficulties the path. So he said, "For awakening or enlightenment, energy is not just a matter of intense effort. It is the wisely applied resource that resists the push of psychological habits. Some of these habits build up into programs, such as perfectionism, dependence on others, obsessive self-criticism, and addictions that cripple our actions and well-being and use up resources." And he goes on to say, "Regulating and directing energy has to do with establishing boundaries." It means boundaries around our behavior. "We must consider what is unskillful, what leads to harmful results, and what should be left aside. And we must consider what is skillful, what channels our energy towards that which is supportive and nourishing." So I would say channeling our energy towards that which is supportive and nourishing includes connecting with a quality of spiritual urgency, which I'll describe, and with spiritual friendship and community, with Sangha. And that includes just like-minded people who are supportive, people whose lives are aligned with the practice in a way that feels like it's supporting your own alignment and your own path. It doesn't necessarily have to be just this, you know, Buddha Dharma Sangha, but good friends who with whom you feel there's a like-mindedness that really nourishes your life and your ability to live in alignment with your highest intentions. So when I'm speaking about spiritual urgency, I'm again speaking about a Pali term that has a specific meaning. It's called Samvega. Samvega, Samvega. And Samvega, well, this is how Bhikkhu Bodhi describes it. "The inner commotion or shock we experience when we are jolted out of our usual complacency by a stark encounter with truths whose full gravity we normally refuse to face." So I think of it as this inner seed of knowing that arises, this bit of knowing that arises, that our typical strategies for managing dukkha and unsatisfactoriness are not going to work, and that there's a way that we must change the way, and we're compelled to seek out a way to live life differently and relate to our experience differently in a way that will lead to less dukkha, less suffering. And this often happens in response to an experience of dukkha, spiritual urgency. And it's so, I mean, I see it in, you know, in these retreats with people, and I feel it in myself. It's just to take a moment to step back and just pause and contemplate the fact that there is actually a word for this experience that so many of us have actually had to some degree, to come on a retreat like this, there must have been some sense of spiritual urgency, some sense that it's the strategies aren't working, and they're seeking a way out. So Samvega is really balanced by, because it can feel like a sense of agitation, it's balanced by another quality which is called Pasada, which is a sort of confirmed confidence that the path, that there is a path, the confirmed confidence in the Dharma path. Confidence and a clarity. So this is the proximate cause of virya, spiritual urgency. It is, so the manifestation is non-collapse, and the proximate cause is this spiritual urgency. When we have that confidence, the courage can grow even more, that pasada. And in fact, the Buddha described the path as the whole of the holy life, as he said that spiritual friendship is in fact the whole of the holy life. And also that he couldn't think of a single more beneficial external factor for supporting the arising of wholesome states than spiritual friendship. So really, the call to the practice that is Samvega is a call to connection with spiritual friendship and Sangha. And we're doing it here. We came together and create, together, all of us and the staff, create this container for practice. And so I would just suggest in daily life practice, as a source of courage, to continue with the practice, connection around spiritual friendship and Sangha is key. So it's important to know when we're talking about these qualities like virya, heroic effort, energy, courage, and samvega, that spiritual urgency, that it's got, we can check it out sometimes to see, and I get this question sometimes, what about that wanting for the practice? What about that urgency? It feels like, wasn't that wanting? Isn't that craving? Isn't that desire? And these are wholesome qualities that sometimes are actually like the urgency can have an edge of unpleasantness to it. So these are wholesome qualities, but sometimes we need to check out and see if they are balanced and has some unwholesomeness crept in. And for me, the biggest, the most effective and fruitful way to do that is to check out whether the sense of urgency, the sense of courage and effort, if that is imbued with patience. Because patience is another parami. It's another of the 10 factors of an awake, 10 qualities of an awakened being. And I think that Winnie mentioned it. I know it was on the board in relationship to equanimity, that equanimity has this quality of patience in it. And so when that urgency, that call, that compelling feeling about needing to move forward with the practice is really also has within it a sense of patience and understanding that this is about taking one step forward again and again and again. It's about beginning again and again and again with care, with gentleness, with understanding, with patience. When that's there, along with the urgency and the courage, then there's a really beautiful, wholesome foundation for our practice. So, of course, wholesome courage supports a greater and greater fearlessness, right? So this willingness, this valor to be present, as Joseph Goldstein describes it. And we need that valor because generally there's some kind of fear. If it's just fear of an unpleasant emotion, a difficult emotion, or it's fear of giving more time to the practice, any kind of fear. It's courage that just kind of comes in and supports greater and greater fearlessness during our lives. And so Ajahn Brahm says about fear and courage, fear is looking into the future with a negative mind. Courage is looking into the future with a positive mind. So somebody asked about hope in here, and I think that this virya, this quality of courage that we need to have for practice, also has this, you know, points to the hope that, or at least at least exactly as Ajahn Brahm said it, looking into the future in terms of our practice with a positive mind. It's the positivity that compels us forward. And this ties into our metta practice also. So metta, it was actually taught as an antidote to fear, according to the parables about the Metta Sutta. It is a quality of goodwill and kindness. So in its presence, ill will and forms of aversion, like fear, are absent. So the cultivation of metta supports greater and greater fearlessness entering into the practice and into our lives. This parable is actually very sweet, I think. The parable of the Metta Sutta being taught as an antidote to fear. It involves these bhikkhus practicing the time of the Buddha, monastics practicing, and they were practicing in a forest, and there were sort of tree spirits there who at some point didn't want them to be present practicing, and basically started doing things that caused them fear. And the practitioners went to the Buddha and asked him for, if he asked them for help, or they went to the Buddha and described what was happening. And he sent them back and told them to practice metta. And they practiced metta, and then they were, the beings calmed down, and they were able to practice in harmony with these beings. So we can also see within our own practice over time, you can check this out, how metta is this, when we have metta, there is this absence of ill will, metta towards ourselves and metta towards others. So metta is also thought of as a form of generosity, of giving the gift of non-fear. So when we have metta, we can create a sort of field where we're giving people a sense of safety. And just invite you to think about how self-metta can give you a sense of safety with yourself, giving yourself the gift of non-fear and therefore courage and energy to do this practice, here, to carry it forth in your daily life. So as we literally practice courage over and over in this practice, moment by moment, with the courage to be present, arising, we can find courage perhaps seeping more and more into our lives, in daily life. Not necessarily in some big, huge way, maybe small ways, but more courage, more fearlessness. And there are quite a few fearless characters in the suttas, and I want to share a passage from the voice of one of these fearless characters to close out this talk. And I like to share her voice as much as I can. Her name is Punika, and she was in one of the enlightened bhikkhunis, so female monastics at the time of the Buddha. But before she was enlightened, she was enslaved, and she had the good fortune to hear the Dhamma, to practice it, and became practiced it quite fruitfully, even as an enslaved person. And this particular sutta, so she was of, you know, as an enslaved person, she was of a lower caste at that time. And she actually came upon this. This is her voice in the suttas, and it is her speaking to a Brahmin who is of, you know, supposedly the highest caste. And so someone who in the hierarchy of that time and in that place had a special access to awakening, very much unlike her in the dominant culture at that time. But in this passage, she gives him a Dharma talk, and she actually kind of gives him a Dharma admonishment. And she tells him off. And and not only that, she does it really effectively. And in the end, he takes refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So she finds him, the story behind the sutta is that she finds him doing what he believes to be an activity that will wash away his bad karma. And this is a story within that, you know, tradition that you can wash away bad karma with just by bathing in water. And so now in the Buddha Dharma, what shifts our karmic stream towards having, you could say, better and better karma is just our good actions. It's our non-harming conduct. It's our ethical conduct, intentional ethical conduct. And so actually just not doing bad deeds, doing good deeds, is what benefits us in the future. And so Punika comes upon this Brahmin and gives him this Dharma talk. And you'll see. And this is just one of those fearless voices from the suttas. So Punika comes upon him, and she says, as he's in the stream, she's going down to get water, and he's bathing. And she says to him, "I'm a water carrier, cold, always going down to the water, from fear of my mistress's beatings, harassed by their anger and words. But you, Brahmin, what do you fear that you're always going down to the water with shivering limbs, feeling great cold?" And the Brahmin says, "Punika, surely you know. You're asking me. I'm doing skillful kama and warding off evil. Whoever, young or old, goes down, does evil actions, is set free from their evil kama by bathing in water." And Punika says to him, "Who taught you this? The ignorant to the ignorant? People through water bathing are set free from evil kama? In that case, all the frogs, turtles, serpents, crocodiles, and anything else that lives in the water would go to heaven. Sheep butchers, pork butchers, fishermen, trappers, thieves, executioners, and any other evildoers would just by bathing in water be set free from evil kama. If these rivers could carry off the evil kama you've done in the past, they'd carry off your good kama as well. And then you'd be completely left out. Whatever it is that you fear that causes you to always go down to the water, don't do it. Don't let the cold hurt your skin." The Brahmin, open to her transmission of the Dharma, says, "I've been following the miserable path, old lady, good lady, and now you've brought me back to the noble path. I will give you this robe for bathing in the water." Punika says, "Let the robe be yours. I don't need it. If you are afraid of pain, if you dislike pain, then don't do any evil kama, in open or in secret. But if you do or will do any evil kama, you'll gain no freedom from pain. Even if you fly up and hurry away, if you're afraid of pain, if you dislike pain, go to the awakened one for refuge. Go to the Dhamma and Sangha. Take on the precepts. That will lead you to your liberation." And the Brahmin did do this. He took refuge and he said, "I go to the awakened one for refuge. I go to the Dhamma and Sangha. I take on the precepts. That will lead to my liberation. Before I was a kinsman to Brahma, now I'm truly a Brahmin. I'm a three-knowledge man, consummate in knowledge, safe, and washed clean." So with the words of Punika, let's just sit for a little bit and let the words dissolve. We have time for walking, and then we'll be back at 9 for chanting and the last sitting. Enjoy the beautiful evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.